The Beetle Horde by Victor Rousseau. Chapter 4. Bram's Story. A sneering chuckle broke from Bram's lips.
Yes, it's me, James Dodd, he answered. I'm a little surprised to see you here, Dodd, but I'm mighty glad. Still insane upon the subject of fossil monotremes, I suppose.
The words came haltingly from Bram's lips, as from those of a man who had lost the habit of easy speech. And Tommy, looking on, and trying to keep in possession of his faculties, had already come to the conclusion that the sounds were inaudible to the beetles. Probably their hearing apparatus was not attuned to such slow vibrations of the human voice. Also, he had discovered that Bram was wearing the discarded shell of one of the monsters. He had not grown the shell himself. It was fastened about his body by a band of the haircloth, fastened to the two protuberances of the elytra, or winged cases, on either side of the dorsal surface. The discovery at least robbed the situation of one aspect of terror. Bram, however he had obtained control of the swarm, was still only a man.
"Yes, still insane," answered Dodd bitterly. "Insane enough to go on believing that the Polyprotodontia and the Dasyuridae, which includes the Paramelidae or bandicoots and the banded anteaters or Myrmecobidae, are not to be found in fossil form for the excellent reason that they were not represented before the Upper Cretaceous period." "You lie! You lie!" screamed Bram. "I have shown to all the world that the Phascalotherium, Amphitherium, Amblotherium, Spalacotherium, and many other orders are to be found in the upper Jurassic rocks of England, Wyoming, and other places. You are the man who denied the existence of the Nototherium, of the marsupial lion, in Pleistocene deposits. You denied that the Dasyuridae can be traced back beyond the Pleistocene, and you stand there and lie to me when you are at my mercy."
"For God's sake, don't aggravate him," whispered Tommy to Dodd. "Don't you see that he's insane? Humor him, or we'll be dead men. Think what the world will lose if you are never able to go back with your specimens," he added craftily.
But Dodd, whose eyes were glaring, said a sublime thing.
"I have given my life to science, and I will never deny my master."
With a screech, which, however, was evidently inaudible to the beetles, Bram leaped at Dodd and seized him by the throat. The two men fell to the ground, the ponderous beetle shell completely covering them. Underneath it, they could be seen to be struggling desperately. All the while, the beetle horde remained perfectly motionless. Tommy thought afterwards that in this fact lay their brightest chances of escape, if Bram's immediate vengeance did not fall on them. Either because Bram was not himself a beetle, or because, in some other way, the swarm instinct was not stirred, the monsters watched the struggle with complete indifference. At the moment, however, Tommy was only concerned with saving Dodd from the madman. He got his foot beneath the shell, then inserted his leg. Using his whole body as a lever, he succeeded in turning Bram over on his back. Then, and only then, the swarm rushed in upon them. Then Tommy realized that he had touched one of the triggers that regulated the beetle's automatism. In another instant, Bram would have been torn to pieces. The needle beaks were darting through the air. The hideous jaws were snapping. Bram's yells rang through the cavern.
Dodging beneath the avalanche of the monsters, Tommy got Bram upon his feet again. The beetle stopped, every movement arrested. Bram's hand went to the pocket of his tattered coat. There came a snap, a flash. Bram had ignited an automatic cigarette lighter. Instantly, the monsters went scurrying away into the distance. And Tommy had another clue. The beetles, living in the dimness of the underworld, could not stand light or fire. He ran to where Jimmy was lying, face upward, on the ground. His face was badly scarred by Bram's nails, and the blood was spurting from a long gash in his throat, made by the sharp flint that was lying beside him. He had some time before discarded his fur coat. Now he pulled off his coat, and, tearing off the tail of his shirt, he made a pad and a bandage, with which he attempted to staunch the blood and bind the wound. It must have taken 10 minutes before the failing heart force enabled him to get the bleeding under control. Dodd had nearly bled to death. His face was drawn and waxen. But because the pulsation was so feeble, the artery had ceased to spurt. Then only did Tommy take notice of Bram. He had been squatting near, and Tommy realized that he had unconsciously observed Bram put some sort of pellets into his mouth. Now he realized that Bram was a drug fiend. That was what had made him walk out of the Greystoke camp in the storm. Bram got up and came toward them. "Is he dead?" he whispered hoarsely. I lost my temper. You too. I don't intend to kill you. There's room for the three of us. I've got plans of the utmost importance to humanity."
"I don't think much of the way you've started to carry them out," answered Tommy bitterly. "No, he's not dead yet. But I wouldn't give much for his chances, even in the best hospital. The best thing you can do now is to go to hell and take your beetles with you," he added.
Bram, without replying, raised his head and emitted from his throat the shrillest whistle that Tommy had ever heard. The response was amazing. Rasping out of the darkness came 8 beetles in pairs. Instead of leaping from an upright position, they trotted in the manner of horses on all fours, their shells, which touched at the edges, forming a solid surface gently rounded in the center so that a man's body could lie there and fit snugly into the groove.
"Help me get him up," said Bram. "Trust me. I'll do my best for him. If we leave him here, they may kill and eat him. I can't trust all those beetle guards."
Tommy hesitated for a moment, then decided to follow Bram's suggestion. Together they raised the unconscious man to the beetle shell couch. Bram seated himself upon the boss of one of the beetle shells in front, and Tommy jumped up behind. Next moment, to his amazement, the trained steeds were flying smoothly through the air, at a rate that could not have been less than 75 to 80 miles an hour. Tommy's shell seat was not a bed of roses, but he hardly noticed that. He was thinking that if Dodd lived, they should be able to turn the tables. For unknown to Bram, he was in possession of the cigarette lighter which he had picked up, and which Bram, in his agitation, had forgotten. It was full of petrol, or some other fluid of a similar nature, which Bram must have obtained from some natural source within the earth. And in an emergency, Tommy knew that he had the means of keeping the beetles at bay. They had traveled for perhaps an hour when a faint light began to glow in the distance. It grew brighter, and a roaring sound became audible. A turn of the track that they were traversing, and the light became a glare. A terrific sight met Tommy's eyes. out of the bowels of the earth. Actually, out of the crust beneath their feet. There shot a pillar of roaring flame, of intense white color, and radiating a heat that was perceptible even at a distance of several hundred yards. The beetle steeds dropped gently to the ground. They halted. Bram got down, grinning.
"Nicely trained horses, what?" he asked. "By the way, you have the advantage of me in names. Who and what are you?"
Tommy told him.
"Well, Travers, it looks as if we're going to be companions for some time to come, and I quite admit you saved my life back there, so we don't want to start with secrets. This is a natural petrol spring, which has probably been burning undiminished for ages. My trained beetles are blind. You didn't happen to notice I'd cut off their antenna? But the rest of the swarm daren't come near it, so that makes me their master. Pretty trick, what's Travers? I'm the Lord of the Flame down here, and I'm using my advantage. But don't get the idea of supplanting me. There are lots of other tricks you don't know anything about, and I'll have to trust you better before—"
He broke off and slipped another pellet into his mouth.
"Help me get Dodd down, if this is our destination," answered Tommy.
They lifted Dodd to the ground. He was conscious now, and moaning for water. The two men carried him into a sort of large cavern, at the farther end of which the fire was roaring. Bram went to a spring that trickled down one side, filled something that looked like a petrified lily calyx, and brought it to Dodd, who drained it. Tommy looked about him. He was astonished to see that the place was, in a way, furnished. Bram had carved out a very creditable couch and several low chairs, evidently with a stone axe, for by the light of the fire, which cast a fair illumination even at that distance, Tommy could see the marks of the implement, rough and irregular, in the wood. On the ground were thick rugs woven of hair, and two or three more rugs of the same material lay on the couch. It was evident that the human herd was expected to furnish textile materials as well as meat.
"Sit down and make yourself comfortable," said Bram, when they had raised Dodd to the couch. "We'll have dinner, and then we'll talk. I can give you a fine vegetarian meal. Those dirty shrimp-eating savages look on me as a cannibal, because I eat the fruits of the trees." He grinned. "There's a bad shortage of food in Submundia, as I've named this part of the world," he went on. "For until I came, the beetles simply devoured the humans wholesale, instead of breeding them, like I taught them. And there's another of the 150-year swarms due to hatch out soon. However, we'll talk about that later. And all those fine fruits going to waste. Excuse me, Travers."
He disappeared, and returned in a minute or two with a small table, piled high with luscious fruits unknown to Tommy, though among them were some that looked like loaves of natural bread. Tommy, whose appetite never failed him even in the worst circumstances, fell to with a will. He was enjoying his meal when he happened to look up, and saw that the penumbra at the edge of the lighted zone was dense with beetles. Thousands, perhaps millions, for they stretched away as far as the eye could see, were packed together, their antennae waving in unison, their heads beneath the shells directed toward the fire. Bram saw Tommy's look of disgust and laughed.
"Fire seems to intoxicate them, Travers," he said. "They always throng the entrance when I'm here. It's as far as they dare to go. They're quite blind in the least light. Care to smoke? I've learned the art of making some quite decent cigars." He produced a handful. "Oh, by the way, you didn't see my lighter anywhere, did you?" he went on, with a pretense of carelessness.
"No," lied Tommy. "I was surprised you—"
"Oh, there's a supply of petrol in the rocks. No matter," answered Bram carelessly. "Your friend looks bad," he added, glancing at Dodd, who had fallen asleep.
"Travers, I'm sorry I lost my temper. The shock of meeting men from the upper world, you know."
Dodd opened his eyes and tried to whisper. Tommy bent over him and listened.
"He wants to know whether he can have that girl to take care of him," he said.
"What, the one I saw you with? Why, she's a call, Travers."
"What do you mean?" asked Tommy.
"Why, useless, you know. There's several of them running loose and waiting to be rounded up. We raise two breeds, one for replenishing the stock and one for meat. She's just a call, a reversion. No use for either purpose. I'll have her brought, by all means.
I like Dodd. I want to get him to like me," Bram went on, with a sort of penitence that had a pathetic touch. "Our little differences. Quite absurd. And I can prove he's wrong in his ideas."
"Make yourself comfortable as long as you're here, Travers, and don't mind me. Only, don't try to escape. The beetles will get you if you do, and there's no way out of here. None that you'll find. And don't try to follow me.
But you're a sensible man, and we'll all get along famously, I'm sure, as soon as Dodd recovers."
End of chapter 4.